Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today I'm talking to Richard Flanagan. His book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, it was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, but that's not why we're talking about it. We're talking about it because it is a true novel of the meeting, often frightening, of cultures. And the title, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, comes from a travel log by the Japanese poet Basho, but another poem that dominates the book is a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson about Ulysses. The narrator is born in Tasmania. Many of the characters in the book are Japanese, Korean. It is a novel of that meeting of cultures that occurs during World War II among prisoners of war in the Pacific. The specific event is the building of the railroad. What is it called?
The Death Railway. That's what it's known as in Australia. It was a 428-kilometre length of railway that was pushed through what were then the a wilderness of jungle in what was known as Siam, now today Thailand, and Burma. And it was a pharaonic project that employed over 250,000 slave labourers working mostly naked with no machinery and some very primitive hand tools. And it was pushed through in about 8 months, and of that number of slave labourers, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 died. And to give your listeners an idea of how many that is, it is more corpses than there are words in my novel, which is, because people can't see it, it's a reasonably sizable novel.
And the vision of death is a vision of sacrifice to the emperor, a vision of sacrifice to the spirit of Japan. The slave masters believe that people who do not want to die for this cause are cowards, avoiding work, slouchers. So we're watching a whole different view of death, of punishment, of sacrifice, and a man from Tasmania who is a doctor, whose vision of help and healing has nothing to do with the culture he's facing, whose practitioners have been taught to humiliate the people they work with by slapping them as hard as they can. And they are in turn humiliated for not slapping hard enough, for being gentle. And so we're watching the formation of a different kind of culture. Now, your father is one of the survivors. Did he teach you? How did you learn about this extraordinary brutality?
Well, there's two aspects to your question. That my father was one of the survivors, along with some other allied troops of the Death Railway. He survived the horror of that, of the hell ships to Japan, of ending up a slave labourer in a coal mine under the inland sea at war's end in Japan. I get often asked how I researched this book. I mean, in truth, I didn't really research it at all. I lived. I grew up with a man of often strange anxieties, but also of a deep compassion and great pity, and also a certain joy in what human beings were. And over the years, I came to understand that I was a child of the death railway, that this had entered my soul. And I think these almost cosmic wounds that people end up carrying with them after they've lived through vast traumas, like a mass crime against humanity, which is what the death railway was, I think these wounds don't end when the particular horror is over. They pass through that individual into their families, into the community around them, sometimes into a nation. The other aspect of your question is about evil, about the notions of death, that the life that the Japanese were strongly imbued with at the time. I was interested in how evil, horror, murder, hate, how these things are deeply buried within every human breast, perhaps even more deeply buried than love, kindness, goodness, hope, and how closely entwined these two things often are, so much so that they're often almost impossible to disentangle. Why it is that in a particular instance a man will act well or a man will act evilly, why it is that someone can believe themselves to be possessed of the highest moral virtue and yet allow that to be hijacked by poisonous ideas of national or racial superiority that lead them to the greatest evil. Why do human beings do this? What is it that leads so many human beings to believe that such evil is not only acceptable, but something they willingly want to be part of? Why do so many young men sign up? So I think these are... It's always wrong to think that evil wears a national face. The face of evil is our face, and we have to look within our own souls to discover what it is. So the book is seeking to understand, or not even, I don't pretend to understand, but seeking to just divine a little more what it is about our own souls that leads us to these acts.
For all of its brutality, it's a highly poetic novel, and implicit in it is the question that Paul Celan says, German, he says, after World War II, is an inappropriate language for poetry. And he garbles German in order to write poems in his native tongue. It has to be strangled first. And the book begins with two epigraphs. One from Celan, Mother, They Write Poems. And the second, to me, more frightening in a way, from Bachot, A Bee Staggers Out of the Peony. Because I'd never seen haiku before, seen almost as a stoic form, that the bee besotted by the life experience of the peony, staggers out. And I started to see in the haikus that you use that there is a sense that poetry is a record of finding the beauty inside the evil.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, but it's true what you say. But the point of language used properly is that it goes beyond judgment. You know, good language doesn't rely on adjectives or adverbs, which are always misleading judgments. That the more accurate the language is, and that Bachot haiku about the bee staggering out of the peony is such a wonderful image of erotic abandon and transcendence and abandonment. captured in the most simple and striking image, that it then becomes capable of much greater meaning than the immediate words. What you learn as a writer is that the more you can distill your language, the more you seek to just accurately represent some aspects, some small aspects of physical reality accurately, the more you allow the reader to enter into it with their own soul and grant it the authority of their history, their character, and discover in it not simply themselves, but the universe of possibilities.
I'm talking to Richard Flanagan about his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, and listeners know that we've spoken about two of his earlier books. To be in the narrow road to the deep north is to be suffering alongside the people who are breaking through a rocky plain to build a railroad that the British said couldn't be built, that they are building in a third of the time it was said to require. They are bleeding, they have dysentery, beriberi, cholera, pellagra, and we are going to be with them every moment, and so are you as a writer. What does that pain feel like to you as you write it?
You've read it as that sort of book, which is entirely appropriate. Other people, particularly women, read it as a love story, and it is. It mattered to me. You're saying, well, you know, what did it feel like? It was important to me. I didn't know how to write this. I wrote this 5 different novels over 12 years, and each one, in the end, I had to delete from my laptop, burn the manuscripts. I tend to work more on manuscripts, destroy it completely, and start again. And each one was completely different. A novel of linked haiku. A haibana, sort of a in that Japanese form of the Nature Journal combining prose and poetry, an Odyssean journey of a group of POWs who only speak in the first person plural. Each of these were years of work, each of them I destroyed. And finally I realised I needed to write it as a love story for this reason, that we know in love we glimpse eternity in a moment that dies immediately after. War is the great story of death. War and death illuminate love. So they're complementary. And love at the same time offers and is the greatest expression of hope. So to me it is a story of love written in the shadow of death, but it is a story of love. And ultimately it has to be about hope, because if we make art about horror and we don't allow for hope, in the end, I think most people revolt against it for this reason. They know there's something in it that's untrue to themselves, their souls, and to life, which is, whether it's right or wrong, whether it is a torment or whether it is an aid, we are, in the end, creatures of hope, and art has to reflect ourselves in that regard.
Well, help me a bit, because I think that this novel's way of thinking about love is singular. The character is presented as needing to make a choice. On one of the prongs of that choice is his love for a woman whom he believes to be dead. This is the protagonist, Dorigo. On the other prong is a woman who is a woman of a higher class than he is. She's proper. Her name is Ella. And he knows that he's lived with her. She is his wife. But he doesn't love her unless love is duration. So in what sense is this novel a love story?
Well, it's a love story in every sense. I was interested in the inexorable, unanswerable question of love, of its infinite forms, erotic love, marital love, familial love, camaraderie love, artistic love. the way that these forms of love are constantly at war with one another. The way that love is always presented, not always, that's wrong to say, but frequently in our popular culture, is confused with morality. But love can be an enormously destructive force, and love exists beyond the categories of good and evil. Love is something that can destroy as much as it can create. And we walk our lives through the rubble that results from these inevitable and ultimately unending conflicts that result.
So if I, while reading, felt that the principle of love in this book was revealed by the relationships among the POWs, and especially by Dorrigo, who is a doctor, who will not take anything because he's an officer. He sends a stake to the lying in hospital where there is no equipment, where there are no walls, no roof, and he sends the stake in to be divided among the sick. He's human. He admits that he didn't like doing that he shouldn't have done it, that he regrets doing it. And yet it was the altruistic side of love that I felt, that the love between the man and the women in this novel was very harsh and very punishing. And I felt that the sacrificial love among the POWs was closer to something that I knew how to call love.
And, you know, that may well be so. I mean, it is not for the writer to judge his characters. It's for the reader and God to judge. But it is for the writer to simply describe them. I mean, I'm as we were talking about before we went on air, I'm well into writing a new novel now, so this is a little removed from me. But thinking about it in light of what you've said, I think Dorrigo Evans is completely a creature of love, and yet he comes to understand that perhaps the hell he lives in is the hell of love, and yet he continues to love. But that's not an argument or even a position. It's just a retrospective observation.
Something that can be said.
Yeah, that could be right or wrong. I mean, when a novel succeeds, it succeeds because it's open to multiple understandings. When a novel fails, it's like a tweet. There's only one interpretation possible. And thankfully, a novel isn't a tweet, you know.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Richard Flanagan about his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Richard Flanagan about his new book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, about a doctor who finds himself in a horrifying Japanese POW camp, struggling with heroism, guilt, and regret in the face of death. The novel has been chosen as one of the 6 shortlisted for the upcoming Booker Prize to be announced in October. I found The Unknown Terrorist to be a novel of the profane world, the world become a world of pole dancing, a world in which the expression available to being was frequently damaged, and that this book pardon me for creating categories like Gould's Book of Fish, is a novel of the sacred world, that there's a seeking for what lasts beyond the most horrible experience, the most devastating experience, what is permanent, what remains. It seems to me to be something like the pulse of your concern.
I was reminded of what Faulkner said, that a writer should live in a monastery of a day and a brothel by night, which is... But again, I hadn't conceived of the novel that way, but it's an interesting reading of it and the others. The terrible dilemma for me in talking to you is that the least interesting person you can talk to about a novel is its author, because they're autistic to its creation. Otherwise, they wouldn't need all those years and all those words to say what they could otherwise pithily convey. You simply are bound to this thing, and it is at the end of the day unknown to you, and I think perhaps necessarily it should be unknown to you. It's not that you don't start a novel without intentions and ambitions and very deliberate ideas, but your novel, I believe, only succeeds to the extent that you escape them, and you escape the constraints of your character and your history, and you open yourself up to all that is beyond you.
I think that we all know that the book that is the narrow road to the deep north is in some transfigured way the movie The Bridge Over the River Kwai, and that one of them is a triumphantist version of something that cannot be put simply, and that your version is a painful, lost, struggling attempt to see what happens years, years, and years later to all of these people, both the slave masters and the POWs and their children. That this is a novel of generations, and it has nothing to do with whether success or one culture or another's version of success is at the heart of the story. Is writing it maintaining the openness to... Well, put it this way. Is writing maintaining a refusal to tell a simple story or to find a simple answer?
Well, I think it's being open to the power of story, isn't it? It's a slightly different thing. It's that because story constantly, like humour, like music, constantly refuses to fit itself into categories. You talk about Bridge Over the River Kwai. It's a fine movie. It's a David Lean movie. But I must confess, I didn't realise till many years later, I mean, I grew up knowing this in the deepest part of me, this horror of the Death Railway. I didn't know Bridge Over the River Kwai was about the same thing, so removed from the reality of what I grew up with. It wasn't till many years later that someone told me it was actually about the Death Railway. I watched it as you would watch a Disney movie or a... It was an entertainment, and a fine entertainment. So it's not a rewriting of it. In terms of the power of story, of seeking to escape judgment and prosecution, I was interested in Japanese forms. That's why I took the title from one of the high points of Japanese culture.
You seem to have an interesting love for the literature of the culture that tormented your father, on the one hand, and the literature that gave us Ulysses, the literature of the questioning as well as questing hero, on the other.
Well, my grandparents were illiterate. My father was the only one of his family to get to high school. he grew up in the steeped in the poetry of the 19th century, and he could recite endless amounts of it to us as children, and always in an apposite way. And I remember saying to him once, "Why do you love words so?" And I stole his answer and put it in the novel. And he said, "Because they were the first beautiful thing I ever knew." And I think when you live and grow up in a highly literate world, you lose the sense of the beauty and the alchemical power of the written word. There is a magic in it. When you don't have it, it oppresses you. It's a dark magic. And when you have it, it is liberating. And it's not... I do have a particular attraction to Japanese literature, that's true, and it is unusual given many things, or given my own background, I should say. But I wanted this book to also be about the love of literature and the power of literature, and also the sense in which literature of itself, though, is no moral guide, because that's a mistake that's constantly made. I notice in your New York Times, they often have this question for writers, what book would you recommend for the president? Well, I mean, the idea that books are moral grammars is particularly strong in North America, but the truth is the best read leader, world leader of the last 100 years would, I think, be Joseph Stalin, who had a comprehensive library and all his books were annotated and thumbed.
I've been talking with Richard Flanagan, author of Narrow Road to the Deep North, published by Knopf. Thank you, Richard, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Lovely.
It's very good to see you again. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Narrow Road to the Deep North at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall and David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Dylan Landis is our guest.